Audible.com, home to over 60,000 audiobooks and more. Details on how to download an audiobook, including the Thalia Book Club and selected short series, are at audible.com/symphonyspace.
From PRI, Public Radio International.
He had no criminal record, had never committed even a minor infraction in school, at home, or in the community, so why had this good kid broken into my house? Why had he decided to steal from me? Why had he made all the bad decisions that had led to his death?
You're listening to B.D. Wong, reading from Sherman Alexie's story, Breaking and Entering, which we'll hear on this edition of Selected Shorts, a series that originates in live performance on stage at Symphony Space in New York City. I'm Isaiah Sheffer. The great American fiction writer and poet Sherman Alexie has grown to be a great friend of our Selected Shorts enterprise. It started by our including one of his unique fictions centering on Native Americans in the Northwest, attempting to cope with the contradictions between modern city life in Seattle and other towns and life on the reservation. Then we perform more and more of his varied short stories, and this season we invited him to host an evening at Symphony Space celebrating work in his new collection, War Dances. We'll now hear one of the stories told that evening in a stunning and powerful reading by the multiple award-winning actor and TV star B.D. Wong. The story is called Breaking and Entering, and here's Sherman Alexie introducing the story on our stage.
The book War Dances is something of a mixtape. I conceived of it this way. It's a mixture of short stories, poetry, call and response sequences, and then just short things that have no definition whatsoever. And this first one is about an Indian who moves into a gentrifying neighborhood and something tragic happens. And I'm very excited that B.D. Wong is going to be reading it. So here's B.D. Wong.
Back in college, when I was first learning how to edit film, how to construct a scene, my professor, Mr. Barron, said to me, "You don't have to show people using a door to walk into a room. If people are already in the room, the audience will understand that they didn't crawl through a window or drop from the ceiling or just materialize. The audience understands that a door has been used. The eyes and mind will make the connection, so you can just skip the door." Mr. Barron, a full-time visual aide, skipped, as he said, "Skip the door." And I laughed, not knowing that I would always remember his bit of teaching. Though, of course, when I tell the story now, I turn my emotive professor into the scene-stealing lead of a Broadway musical. "Skip the door, young man," Mr. Barron sings in my stories, my lies and exaggeration, skipping across the stage with a top hat in one hand and a cane in the other. "Skip the door, old friend, and you will be set free." Skip the door is a good piece of advice. A maxim, if you will, that I've applied to my entire editorial career, if not my entire life. To state it in less poetic terms, one would say an editor must omit all unnecessary information. So in telling you this story with words, not film or video stock, in constructing its scenes, I will attempt to omit all unnecessary information. But oddly enough, in order to skip the door in telling this story, I am forced to begin with a door, the front door of my home, on 27th Avenue in the Central District neighborhood of Seattle, Washington. 1 year ago, there was a knock on that door. I heard it, but I did not rise from my chair to answer. As a freelance editor, I work at home, and I had been struggling with a scene from a locally made film, an independent. Written, directed, and shot by amateurs, the footage was both incomplete and voluminous. Simply stated, there was far too much of nothing. Moreover, it was a love scene. a graphic sex scene, in fact. And the director and the producer had somehow convinced a naive and ambitious local actress to shoot the scene full frontal, graphically so. And this was not supposed to be a pornographic movie. This was to be a tender coming-of-age work of art. But it wasn't artistic, or not the kind of art it pretended to be. This young woman had been exploited. With her permission, of course, but I was still going to do my best to protect her. Now, don't get me wrong, I'm not a prude. I mean, I've edited and enjoyed sexual and violent films that were far more graphic, but I'd spotted honest, transformative vulnerability in that young actress's performance. Though the director and the producer thought she'd just been acting, had created her fear and shame through technical skill, I knew better. And so by editing out the more gratuitous nudity and focusing on faces and small pieces of dialogue, and by paying more attention to fingertips than to what those fingertips were touching, I was hoping to turn a sleazy gymnastic sex scene into an exchange that resembled how two people in new love might actually touch each other. Was I being paternalistic, condescending, and hypocritical? Sure. After all, I was being paid to work with exploiters. So didn't that mean I was also being exploited as I helped exploit the woman? And what about the young man, the actor, in the scene? Was he dumb and vulnerable as well? Though he was allowed, was legally bound to keep his penis hidden, wasn't he more exploited than exploiter? These things are hard to define. Still, even in the most compromised of situations, one must find a moral center. But how could I find any center with that knocking on the door? It had become an evangelical pounding. Bang, 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 bang. It had to be the 4-4 beat of a Jehovah's Witness. Or a Mormon. Bang, cha, bang, cha. It had to be the iambic pentameter of a Sierra Club shill. Or a magazine sales kid. Trust me, nobody interesting or vital has ever knocked on a front door at 3 in the afternoon. So I ignored the knocking, and I kept at my good work. And, sure enough, my potential guest stopped the noise and went away. I could hear feet pounding down the stairs, and there was only silence, or rather, the relative silence of my urban neighborhood. But then, a few moments later, I heard a window shatter in my basement. Is shatter too strong a verb? I heard my window break. But break seems too weak a verb. As I visualize the moment, as I edit in my mind, I add the soundtrack, or rather, I completely silence the soundtrack. I cut the sounds of the city, the planes overhead, the cars in the streets, the boats on the lake, the televisions and the voices and the music and the wind through the trees, until one can only hear shards of glass dropping onto a hardwood floor. And then one hears, feels, the epic thump of 2 feet landing on that same floor. Somebody, the same person who had knocked on my front door to ascertain if anybody was home, had just broken and entered my life. Now, please forgive me if my tenses, my past, present, and future, blend. But one must understand that I happen to be one editor who is not afraid of jump cuts, of rapid flashbacks and flash forwards. In order to be terrified, one must lose all sense of time and place. When I heard those feet hit the floor, I traveled back in time. I de-evolved, I suppose, and I became a primitive version of myself. I had been a complex organism, but I'd turned into a 202-pound, one-celled amoeba. And that amoeba knew only fear. Looking back, I suppose I should have just run away. I could have run out the front door into the street, or the back door onto the patio, or the side door off the kitchen into the alley, or even through the door into the garage, where I could have dived through the dog door cut into the garage and made my canine-like escape. But here's the salt of the thing. Though I cannot be certain, I believe that I was making my way toward the front door. After all, the front door was the only place in my house where I could be positive that my intruder was not waiting. But in order to get from my office to the front door, I had to walk past the basement door. And as I walked past the basement door, I spotted the baseball bat. It wasn't my baseball bat. Now, when one thinks of baseball bats, one conjures images of huge slabs of ash wielded by steroid-fueled freaks. But that particular bat belonged to my 10-year-old son. It was a Little League bat, so it was comically small. I could easily swing it with one hand, and had, in fact, often swung it one-handed as I hit practice grounders to the little second baseman of my heart, my son, my Maximilian, my Max. Yes, I'm a father and a husband. That is information you need to know. My wife, Wendy, and my son were not in the house to give me the space and time I needed to finish editing the film. My wife had taken our son to visit her mother and father in Chicago. They'd been gone for 1 week and would be gone for another. So, to be truthful, I was in no sense being forced to defend my family, and I'd never been the kind of man to defend his home, his property, his shit. In fact, I'd often laughed at the news footage of silly men armed with garden hoses as they tried to defend their homes from wildfires. I always figured those men would die, go to hell, and spend the rest of eternity having squirt gun fights with demons. So, with all that information in mind, why did I grab my son's baseball bat and open the basement door? Why did I creep down the stairs? Trust me, I've spent many long nights awake asking myself those questions. There are no easy answers. Of course, there are many men, and more than a few women, who believe I was fully within my rights to head down those stairs and confront my intruder. There are laws that define, that frankly encourage, the art of self-defense. But since I wasn't interested in defending my property, and since my family and I were not directly being threatened, what part of myself could I have possibly been defending? In the end, I think I wasn't defending anything at all. I'm an editor, an artist, and I like to make connections. So I am paid to make connections, and so I wonder, did I walk down those stairs because I was curious? Because a question had been asked, who owned the feet that landed on my basement floor, and I, the editor, wanted to discover the answer? So yes, slowly I made my way down the stairs and through the dark hallway and turned the corner into our downstairs family room, the man cave, really, with a big television and the pool table, and saw a teenage burglar. I stood still and silent, standing with his back to me, obsessed with the task, the crime at hand. He hadn't yet realized that I was in the room with him. Well, let me get something straight. Up until that point, I hadn't made any guesses as to the identity of my intruder. I mean, yes, I live in a black neighborhood, and I'm not black, and there had been news of a series of local burglaries perpetrated by black teenagers, but I swear, none of that entered my mind. And when I saw him, the burglar, rifling through my DVD collection and shoving selected titles into his backpack, he was a felon with cinematic taste, I guess. And that was a strangely pleasing observation. I didn't think, there's a black teenager stealing from me. I only remember being afraid and wanting to make my fear go away. Get the f*** out of here, I screamed. You f***ing f***er. The black kid was so startled that he staggered into my television, cracking the screen, and nearly fell before he caught his balance and ran for the broken window. I could have, would have let him make his escape, and then he stopped and turned back toward me. Why did he do that? I don't know. He was young and scared and made an irrational decision, or maybe it wasn't irrational at all. He'd slashed his right hand when he crawled through the broken window, so he must have decided the opening with its jagged glass edges was not a valid or safe exit. Who would ever think a broken window was a proper entry or exit? So he searched for a door, but the door was behind me. He paused, weighing his options, and sprinted toward me. He was going to bulldoze me. Once again, I could have made the decision to avoid conflict and step aside, but I didn't. As that kid ran toward me, I swung the baseball bat with one hand. I often wonder what would have happened if that bat had been made of wood. When Max and I had gone shopping for bats, I tried to convince him to let me buy him a wooden one, an old-fashioned slugger, the type I'd used when I was a little leaguer. I've always been a nostalgic guy. But my son recognized that a $10 wooden bat purchased at Target was not a good investment. That wood one will break easy, Max had said. I want the lumalum one. Of course, he meant to say aluminum. We'd both laughed at his mispronunciation, and I'd purchased the lumalum bat. So it was a metal bat that I swung one-handed at the black teenager's head. If it had been cheap and wooden, perhaps the bat would have snapped upon contact and dissipated the force. Perhaps, but this bat did not snap. It was strong and sure. So when it made full contact with the kid's temple, he dropped to the floor and did not move. He was dead. I had killed him. I fell to my knees next to the kid, dropped my head onto his chest, and wept. I don't remember much else about the next few hours, but I called 911, opened the door for the police, and led them to the body, and I answered and asked questions. Did he have a gun or a knife? I don't know. No, well, I didn't see one. He attacked you first. He ran at me. He was going to run me over. And that's when you hit him with the bat. Yes, it's my son's bat. It's so small. I can't believe it's strong enough. Is he really dead? Yes. Who is he? We don't know yet. His name was Elder Briggs. Elder. Such an unusual name for anybody, especially a 16-year-old kid. He was a junior at Garfield High School, a B student, and backup point guard for the basketball team, an average kid. A good kid, by all accounts. He had no criminal record, had never committed even a minor infraction in school, at home, or in the community, so why had this good kid broken into my house? Why had he decided to steal from me? Why had he made all the bad decisions that had led to his death? The investigation was quick but thorough, and I was not charged with any crime. It was self-defense. But then, nothing is ever clear, is it? I was legally innocent, that much is true, but was I morally innocent? I wasn't sure. And neither were a significant percentage of my fellow citizens. Shortly after the police held the press conference that exonerated me, Elder's family, his mother, his father, older brother, aunts, uncles, cousins, friends, and priest organized a protest. It was small, only 40 or 50 people. But how truly small can a protest feel when you are the subject, the object of that protest? I watched the live coverage of the event. My wife and son, after briefly returning from Chicago, had only spent a few days with me before they fled back to her parents. We wanted to protect our child from the media, an ironic wish, considering that the media were only interested in me because I'd killed somebody else's child. The police don't care about my son because he's black, Elder's mother, Althea, said to a dozen different microphones and as many cameras. He's just another black boy killed by a white man, and none of these white men care. As Althea continued to rant about my whiteness, some clever producer and his editor cut into footage of me, the white man who owned a baseball bat, walking out of the police station as a free man. It was a powerful piece of editing. It made me look pale and guilty. But all of them, Althea, the other protesters, the reporters, producers, and editors, were unaware of one crucial piece of information. I am not a white man. I am an enrolled member of the Spokane tribe of Indians. Oh, I don't look Indian, or at least not typically Indian. Some folks assume I'm a little bit Italian or Spanish or perhaps Middle Eastern. Most folks think I'm just another white guy who tans well. And since I just spent months in a dark editing room, I was at my palest. But I grew up on the Spokane Indian Reservation, the only son of a mother and father who were also Spokane Indians who grew up on our reservation. Yes, both of my grandfathers had been half white, but they both died before I was born. I'm not trying to be holy here. I wasn't a traditional Indian. I didn't dance or sing powwow, or speak my language, or spend my free time marching for Indian sovereignty. And I'd married a white woman. One could easily mock my lack of cultural connection, but one could not question my race. Well, that's not true, of course. People, especially other Indians, always doubted my race. And I'd always tried to pretend it didn't matter. I was confident about my identity, but it did hurt my feelings. So when I heard Althea Riggs misidentify my race and watch the media covertly using editing techniques to confirm her misdiagnosis, I picked up my cell phone and dialed the news station. "Hello," I said to the receptionist, "this is George Wilson. I'm watching your coverage of the protests and I must issue a correction." "Wait, what?" the reception asked. "Are you really George Wilson?" "Yes, I am." "Hold on," she said. "Let me put you straight through to the producer." So the producer took the call, and after asking a few questions to further confirm my identity, he put me on live. So my voice played over images of Althea Riggs weeping and wailing, of her screaming at the sky, at God. How could I have allowed myself to be placed in such a compromising position? How could I have been such an idiot? How could I have been so callous and self-centered? "Hello, Mr. Wilson," the evening news anchor said. "I understand you have something you'd like to say." "Yes," my voice carried into tens of thousands of Seattle homes. "I'm watching the coverage of the protest, and I insist on a correction. I am not a white man. I am an enrolled member of the Spokane tribe of Indians." Yes, that was my first official public statement about the death of Elder Briggs. It didn't take clever editing to make me look evil. I had accomplished this in one take, live and uncut. I was suddenly the most hated man in Seattle and the most beloved. My fellow liberals spoke of my lateral violence and the destructive influence of colonialism on the indigenous, while conservatives lauded my defensive stand and lonely struggle against urban crime. Local bloggers posted hijacked footage of the most graphically violent films I'd edited. And finally, a local news program obtained rough footage of the film I'd been working on when Elder Briggs broke into my house. Though I had, through judicious editing, been trying to protect the young actress, a black actress, the news only played the uncut footage of the obviously frightened and confused woman. And when the reporters ambushed her name was Tracy, she, of course, could only respond that, yes, she felt as if she'd been violated. I didn't blame her for that. I agreed with her, but none of that mattered. I could in no way dispute the story, the cleverly edited series of short films that had been made about me. Yes, I was a victim, but I didn't for one second forget that Elder Briggs was dead. I was ashamed and vilified, but I was alive. I spent most of that time alone in my basement, in the room where I had killed Elder Briggs. When one spends that much time alone, one ponders, and when one ponders, one creates theories, hypotheses to explain the world. Oh, hell, forget rationalization. I was pissed, mostly at myself for failing to walk away from a dangerous situation, and I was certainly pissed at the local media, who had become as exploitative as any pornographic movie maker, but I was also pissed at Althea and Elder Briggs. Yes, the kid was a decent athlete. Yes, the kid was a decent student. Yes, the kid was a decent person. But he had broken into my house. He had smashed my window and was stealing my DVDs. And if I had not been home, would have stolen my computer and television and stereo and every other valuable thing in my house. And his mother, Althea, instead of explaining why her good and decent son had broken and entered a stranger's house committing a felony, had instead decided to blame me and accuse me of being yet another white man who was always looking to maim another black kid, had already maimed generations of black kids, when in fact I was a reservation Indian who had been plenty f***ed myself by generations of white men. So, Althea, do you want to get into a pain contest? Do you want to participate in the genocidal Olympics? Whose tragic history has more breadth and depth and length? Oh, Althea, why the hell was your son in my house? And oh my God, it was a Little League baseball bat. It was only 20 inches long and it weighed less than 3 pounds. I could have hit 100 men in the head, maybe 1,000 or 1 million, and not done anything more than giving them a headache. But on that one day, on that one bitter afternoon, I took a swing, a stupid, one-handed, unlucky cut, and killed a kid, a son, a young man who was making a bad decision, but who maybe had brains and heart and soul enough to stop making bad decisions. Oh, Jesus. I murdered somebody's potential. Oh, Mary. It was self-defense, but it was still murder. I confess. I'm a killer. How does one survive these revelations? One just lives. Or rather, one just finally walks out of his basement and realizes that the story is over. It's old news. There are new villains and heroes, criminals and victims to be defined and examined and tossed aside. Elder Briggs and I were suddenly and equally unimportant. My life became quiet again. I took a job teaching private school white teenagers how to edit video. They used their newly developed skills to make documentaries about poor brown people in other countries. It's not oil that runs the world, it's shame. My Max was always going to love me, even when he began to understand my limitations. I didn't know what my wife thought of my weaknesses. Weeks later, in bed after lovemaking, she interrogated me. Honey, she said. Yes, I said. Can I ask you something? Anything. With that kid, did you lose your temper? What do you mean? I asked. Well, you have lost your temper before. Just one time. Yes, but you broke your hand when you punched the wall. Do you think that I lost my temper with Elder Briggs? I asked. My wife paused before answering, and in that pause, I heard all of her doubt and fear. So I got out of bed, dressed, and left the house. I decided to drive to see a hot new independent film, a gory war flick that pretended to be anti-war. But first, stepped into a mini-mart to buy candy I could smuggle into the theater. I was standing in the candy aisle, trying to decide between a payday and a Snickers, when a group of young black men walked into the store. They were drunk or high, and they were cursing the world in a strangely friendly way. How is it that black men can make a word like motherfucker sound jovial? There are people, white folks mostly, who are extremely uncomfortable in the presence of black people. And I know plenty of Indians, my parents, for example, who are also uncomfortable around black folks. As for me, I suppose I'd always been the kind of non-black person who celebrated himself for not being uncomfortable around blacks. But now, as I watched those black men jostle one another up and down the aisles, I was afraid. No, I was nervous. What if they recognized me? What if they were friends of Elder Briggs? What if they attacked me? Nothing happened, of course. Nothing ever really happens, you know? Life is infinitesimal and incremental and inconsequential. Those young black men paid for their energy drinks and left the store. I paid for my candy bar, walked out to my car, and drove toward the movie theater. One block later, I had to hit my brakes when those same black guys jaywalked across the street in front of me. All of them stared me down and walked as slowly as possible through the crosswalk. I lived in this neighborhood for years, and I'd often had this same encounter with young black men. It was some remnant of the warrior culture, I suppose. When it had happened before, I had always made it a point to smile goofily and wave to the black men who were challenging me. Since they thought I was a dorky white guy, I'd behave like one. I'd be what they wanted me to be. But this time, when those black men walked in slow motion in front of me, I did not smile or laugh. I just stared back at them. I knew I could hit the gas and slam into them and hurt them, maybe even kill them. I knew I had that power. And I knew I would not use that power. But what about these black guys? What power did they have? They could only make me wait at an intersection. And so I waited. I waited until they walked around the corner and out of my vision. I waited until another driver pulled up behind me and honked his horn. I was supposed to move, and so I went.
B.D. Wong read Sherman Alexie's Breaking and Entering. After a short break, we'll hear Sherman Alexie in conversation and performing a sampling of his poetry from War Dances. You're listening to Selected Shorts, recorded live in performance at Symphony Space in New York City and at other venues nationwide, from PRI, Public Radio International. Welcome back to Selected Shorts. As part of our Sherman Alexie evening, we invited his friend, the novelist Rick Moody, to talk with him on stage. We'll hear part of that conversation right now.
Well, let's begin, if we can, with the form of the book. You talked about it a little bit when you came out at first to introduce BD. But I think there's more to say on the subject. It's a very interesting, hybridized form, this book. I assume that you'd been lying in wait to do this for some many years. Can you tease out how it came to you?
Well, I am multi-genre. I've always been multi-genre. My very first book, The Business of Fantasy Dancing, contained poems and stories, which was kind of unusual at that point to actually say it on the cover, poems and stories. A first book by a 25-year-old from Spokane, Washington that said poems and stories and had an Indian dancing on the cover. You know, it should have sold 12 copies. But So I've had a hybrid career, and it's also because of other Native American writers. My mentors, my artistic mentors, were all hybrid writers, so it's just part of who we are as a people. But one of the things about this particular book was sort of in reaction to the changes in literature and the changes in the idea of what a book is. And sometimes it feels to me like technology and time are going so much faster and faster that memories aren't even being created, that things are going too fast for memory to be created. And I'm nostalgic for nostalgia. And I'm 43. You know, the joke is Rez ears are like dog ears, so I'm actually, you know, somewhere like 97. But still, I'm 43 and nostalgic. What does that say for those of you who are older than me? Like you. So that all combined in my head, the multi-genre, the nostalgia, the digital technology, and I thought, you know, I wanted to create a book that sort of was old-fashioned. And it's strange to think that a book that had short stories and poems in it as a hybrid could be something old-fashioned.
And when you have a story in mind, does it immediately propose itself as a poem or a short story, or do you move fluidly between them so that it could be in either form?
Moments stay with me for a long time often before they become something. I don't know what they're going to become. I mean, just to give you some example, the moment that's staying with me right now, at the beginning of the book tour, I did an interview at KUOW, an NPR station in Seattle, and what you do is you park at the university bookstore. Or what I do, is you park at the university bookstore, you walk through it to go to the radio station, then you come back, you buy a book, and get your parking validated. I just love the luxury of buying a book to pay for my parking. I just enjoy that it feels like the barter system. But when I walk through the bookstore, on the way there, we eavesdrop on people, we watch people, we steal from them, and I could tell by their body language they were arguing. And there's nothing more narratively exciting to a writer than a romantic couple arguing. And I'm married too, so I wanted to get in there and maybe get some, you know, new weapons. And then I edged up closer, and I was on a time frame too because I had to get to the interview. But I realized she was breaking up with him in a bookstore.
Wow.
And what immediately came to my mind was how you get food poisoned by something, and then you can never eat that food again. And I thought, can you get your heart broken enough in a place that you can never go into that kind of place again? And I thought, what if this guy loves books, but now whenever he walks into a bookstore, he gets nauseous remembering that he got his heart broken in a bookstore. So this narrative moment has been playing and playing and playing in my head, and it just keeps talking to me. And I don't know what it's going to become. But if it's going to become a poem, what will usually happen is a rhyming couplet will occur. I may not ever use the rhyming couplet, but a rhyming couplet will occur, and that hasn't happened yet. So I'm not sure what I'm going to rhyme with bookstore. You know, when something just came to me, actually.
Yeah, I have one too.
You know, a couple of rhymes. Look, you whore.
I have the very same one.
Yeah. So I don't know. But also now, what I told you backstage is this book of short stories and poems that is in some sense fragmented, it has themes running through it. For the paperback, I'm actually turning it into a novel.
And beyond slapping those two words on the front cover, how is that process going to manifest itself?
That's all we're doing. Well, we are debating the ways in which to package it, to make it clear. I'm thinking we're going to change the title of the book, but we're going to use the original cover art in a form on the book, which we think may or may not be, we're debating, is to use the original cover and put it on a cassette tape on the cover so that it's a mixtape on the cover where War Dances is on there, but the big cover says whatever the new title is. The one that's in my head right now is from a poem in the book called The Shaman of Ice Cream. And on the back cover have side A and side B. Side A, the novel, and then side B will be the original table of contents. So to give some indication of what's going on. But inside the book, what has happened is, on this book tour, the book is about loss. It's about the death of my father, the death of the newspaper industry, the death of all sorts of parts of Native culture. But on this book tour, it used to be on book tours, as you know this, you've been doing this as long as I have, it used to be when you landed in a city, somebody would pick you up, and you would drive from media place to media place, magazines, newspapers, radio, TV, your day would be filled with local media talking about your book, talking about all books, talking about literature. And this tour, I spent most afternoons watching movies. I saw 25 matinees this fall. And I really reminisced about, writers often talk about book tours as being brutal, and they are. They're horrible travel. It's like being a rock star without sex, drugs, or rock. But it's also the way you meet people, other writers, book lovers, audiences, booksellers, people who love books. And, I've made hundreds of friends over the last 20 years doing this. And it's been beautiful. I mean, I built a career day by day, week by week, town by town, university by university, bookstore by bookstore, by interpersonal connection, by actually being in the presence of fans and potential fans. And it's gone. And it's gone. And my career is fine. People think I'm worried about my career when I talk this way, and I'm not. I'm doing well, thank you. But I mourn the fact that no other young writer will get that chance again. I don't think I could build a career in this environment. I have developed the kind of skills that make me able to compete in this environment, but as we were talking backstage, writers, we're natural introverts. We're natural solitary creatures. But the way technology is changing our job, we're going to have to become and pretend to be people we are not. And I worry that there is some amazing man or woman out there, some young person, who will not get an audience because they lack the public relations skills that are necessary to survive in this digital world. And so the narrative part of the novel is also somebody called the author remembering what it was like to be a traveling storyteller and what he will miss.
Let's move in a slightly different direction. I was moved, transported by this book, particularly in one register, and that is the way politics always works in what you do. In fact, Sherman and I met at a festival in France in 2004. It was a month before the presidential election. And for some reason that day, you were a magnet for political controversy at that festival. Every word that came out of the guy's mouth, it was a firestorm in the European press. But I noticed, not only then, but in all my encounters with your work over the years, that it's as if it hasn't occurred to you that American fiction could be apolitical. It's just hardwired into you as a writer that politics is always there. Is that a correct perception?
Yes. but it's interesting, too. I think it's a sort of, I think I made the joke earlier, it's sort of a precondition of being Indian. I mean, we are assigned two numbers at birth, Social Security number and tribal ID number. So, you know, we are marked immediately. You know, we are bagged and tagged. I know you always measure the oppression of any particular kid by the age at which they have their first political thought. Yeah, I was three. I remember it vividly because I was standing in line on my reservation to get government food. And I had just come from home where on the TV we had seen the news where Russians were standing in line to get toilet paper. And I remember looking up at my dad, which is a funny thing about memory, looking up at my dad was 5'7", so I was looking up at my dad, and I said, "Dad, are we communists?" And then he had to explain to a, little kid, no, but I look back and I think, in the fictional version, I also say, "Are we Red Reds?" So, in a sense, you can't escape it. As much as I try, I would love to sometimes. Sometimes I try to write just things. But it's so fraught, and also being the Native American who has this career. I mean, I just read an interview in Poets and Writers with Sherman Bitsui, who's a Navajo poet, a beautiful book he's written. And the poor guy had to answer a question about me. And I thought, oh, you poor guy. And in the article about him, they said, "Sherman Alexie, Native American superstar." And I'm thinking, oh, Sherwin, I'm sorry. Why is they saying that in there? So there's all this stuff, like writing poems. I'd love to just write a nature poem. But an Indian can't write a nature poem. You know, I can't praise a pine tree because then everybody will do that poetry thing. Oh. I'm naturally combative, but sometimes it ends up feeling like I have to be combative in that way.
So that leads you in this book to attempt what I think is an unparalleled aesthetic feat. You've made an emotionally credible Republican senator.
Oh, yep, a white guy. In a story, The Senator's Son, which is interesting. It's going to be one of the most rewritten short stories in the book. Because I think I failed at the end a little bit there in that story. No, I shouldn't say I think. I failed a little bit at the end of that story. I realized I had set it up in such a way to make that character, the father character in this book, heroic in a way. At least living up to his ideals, no matter how far away from my ideals his are. I wanted him to live up to them. And I kind of lefty'd out at the end. I took the lefty escape hatch from my own story. I did what you said until the very end. So if you haven't read it, you'll know, But I'm going to go back in, and I'm going to fix that. I'm going to have a politician live up to his politics. In other words, a fable.
So, if it's going to be a novel, who's the protagonist of the novel to be?
The protagonist. I know who the antagonist is. The protagonist is the idea of being a writer in a rapidly changing culture.
That's a great idea.
Yeah.
I admire this novel. I'm looking forward to it, even though I've already read it.
I'm really increasingly disheartened by people pretending that digital technology creates real emotions. I'm tired of people saying, "I have Facebook friends." I have friends. and
unfortunately, on that elegiac note, we're out of time for now, I believe. Great American novelist, Sherman Alexie.
Thank you. Great American novelist, Rick Moody.
That was Sherman Alexie talking with the novelist Rick Moody about his book, War Dances. As you heard, the book War Dances contains some of Sherman Alexie's poetry, and we thought you might like to have a chance to hear that. So we asked him to step into his public radio station studio and record some of his poems to include here. Here now is the poet, Sherman Alexie.
The Limited.
I saw a man swerve his car and try to hit a stray dog. But the quick mutt dodged between two parked cars and made his escape. God, I thought, did I just see what I think I saw? At the next red light, I pulled up beside the man and stared hard at him. He knew that I'd seen his murder attempt, but he didn't care. He smiled and yelled loud enough for me to hear him through our closed windows. Don't give me that face unless you're going to do something about it. Come on, tough guy. What are you going to do? I didn't do anything. I turned right on the green. He turned left against traffic. I don't know what happened to that man or the dog, but I drove home and wrote this poem. Why do poets think they can change the world? The only life I can save is my own. Bird watching at night. What kind of bird is that? An owl. What kind of bird was that? Another owl. Oh, that one was too quick and small to be an owl. What was it? A quick and small owl. One night, when I was 16, I was driving with my girlfriend up on Little Falls Flat, and this barn owl swooped down over the road maybe 50 feet or so in front of us and came flying straight toward our windshield. It was huge, pterodactyl size, and my girlfriend screamed, and, well, I screamed too because that thing was heading straight for us. But you know what I did? I slammed on the gas and I sped toward that owl. Do you know why I did that? Because you wanted to play chicken with the owl. Exactly. So what happened? When we were maybe a second from smashing into each other, that owl just flapped its wings, but barely. What's a better word than flap? What's a word that still means flap, but a smaller flap? How about slant? Oh, yes, that's pretty good. So like I was saying, as that owl was just about to smash into our windshield, it slanted its wings and slanted up into the dark. And it was so friggin' amazing, you know. I just slammed on the brakes and nearly slid into the ditch. And my girlfriend and I were sitting there in the dark with the engine tick-tick-ticking like some kind of bomb, but an existential bomb, like it was just measuring out the endless nothingness of our lives because that owl had nearly touched us but was gone forever. And I said something like, "That was magnificent." And my girlfriend, you want to know what she said? She said something like, "I'm breaking up with you." Dang, that's exactly what she said. And I asked her, "Why are you breaking up with me?" And do you know what she said? She said, "I'm breaking up with you because you are not an owl." Yes, yes, yes. And you know what? I have never stopped thinking about her. It's been 27 years and I still miss her. Why is that? Brother, you don't miss her. You miss the owl. Ode to Small Town Sweethearts. Oh, when you are driving through a blizzard and your vision has been reduced, has been scissored into two headlights and a noose, how joyous to come upon the wizard of snowplows driving his glorious machine. Now you will survive if you ride in his slipstream. He pushes back the fear and ice. This is not a time for prayer, so you scream with joy, "Snowplow, snowplow, snowplow, snowplow." As he leads you into the next snowed-in town, you are not dead. You did not wreck. And you know a family who lives here, the Browns. They run that little diner on Main Street. It must be shut at this dark hour, 3:15, but the son Mark plays power forward for the high school, the Wolverines, and once broke your nose with a stray elbow while playing some tough defense. And you know him and call him friend. So you park your car and trudge through the snow, cursing and or blessing this fierce winter, to find Mark and his dad awake and cooking chicken fried steaks for a dozen other survivors and sinners. "Dang," Mark says, "why are you out in this stuff?" "For a girl," you say, and Mark nods. Mortals have always fought the gods and braved epic storms for love and or lust. So don't be afraid to speak honestly about how you obeyed beauty's call. And though your triumph was small, you can still sing of your teenage odyssey. Home of the Braves. When my female friends are left by horrid spouses and lovers, I commiserate. I send gifts, powwow songs and poems, and wonder why my gorgeous friends cannot find someone who knows them as I do. Is the whole world deaf and blind? I tell my friends, I'd marry you tomorrow. I think I'm engaged to 36 women, my harem, platonic, bookish, and enraged. I love them. But it would scare them. No, of course, they already know that I can be just one more boy, a toy warrior who explodes into silence and warpaths with joy. Ode to mixtapes. These days, it's too easy to make mixtapes. CD burners, iPods, and iTunes have taken the place of vinyl and cassette, and soon enough, clever introverts will create quicker point-and-click ways to declare one's love, lust, friendship, and favor. But I miss the labor of making old-school mixtapes, the mid-air acrobatics of recording one song at a time. It sometimes took days to play, choose, pause, ponder, record, replay, erase, and replace. But there was no magic wand. It was blue-collar work. A great mixtape was sculpture designed to seduce and let the hounds loose. A great mixtape was a three-chord parade led by that first song, something bold and brave, a heat seeker, like Prince with Cream, or Let's Get It On by Marvin Gaye. The next song was always Patsy Cline's Sweet Dreams or something by Hank. But oh, the last track was the vessel that contained the most devotion and pain and made promises that you couldn't take back.
Sweet.
Sherman Alexie, reading from the poetry of Sherman Alexie. If you've always wanted to be a selector of shorts yourself, here's your chance. On June 9th, 2010, Selected Shorts at Symphony Space in New York will feature published stories selected by you, our audience nationwide. Go to selectedshorts.org/favorite to submit your story suggestions. Then in the spring, you'll vote for your favorite of the final contenders. This radio program is now available as a free podcast, so you can subscribe and listen to the download on your computer or MP3 player anytime, anywhere. Subscribe today on iTunes or at npr.org or pri.org. Selected Shorts is produced by Catherine Minton and directed by Isaiah Sheffer. The executive director of Symphony Space is Cynthia Elliott. Our radio producer is Sarah Montague, and our production assistant is Miranda Schaefer. The readings are recorded by Miles B. Smith, and our mix engineer is Stu Kennedy. Major support for Selected Shorts is provided by Houghton Mifflin, publishers of the Best American Short Stories, edited in 2009 by Alice Siebold. Additional support is provided by the Dungannon Foundation, sponsor of the Ray Award for the Short Story, the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art, New York State Council on the Arts, a state agency, the Henry Nias Foundation, Lila Acheson Wallace Theater Fund of the New York Community Trust, and Warren and Jane Weiss and the Applebaum Foundation. Selected Shorts is a co-production of Symphony Space and WNYC Radio in New York and is distributed nationwide by PRI, Public Radio International.
Support for this program comes from Audiophile Magazine, a print and online resource for audiobook reviews, recommendations, and features on audiobook narrators. More on the world of audiobooks at audiophilemagazine.com.
Support for this program comes from this station and Public Radio International stations nationwide and is made possible in part by the PRI Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
PRI, Public Radio International.